Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Doran, and this is the 10x9 podcast. It seemed like it might never happen, but at last, January is over. There are snowdrops and daffodils pushing through, and according to ancient Irish tradition, it's now spring. And who would go against tradition? Anyway, put a spring in your step. There are 3 stories on this podcast for you, told at different events in the past 12 months.
I flew back from Dublin and spent a horrible night telling him it was over, but he reacted by smashing his computer and hard drive against the wall. Somehow we managed to repair it with tape.
"Listen, son, never steal a man's drink," he said in a thick Glaswegian accent. He paused, then grabbed Peter's shoulders and enveloped him in a massive bear hug.
I stepped into a car exhibit with my grandfather in the museum, without reading what the exhibit was called. As when me and my grandfather pressed buttons in the car, we heard certain bedroom sounds and educational anecdotes about sex.
A toxic relationship comes to an end, a schoolboy learns a valuable life lesson, and a day out in Warsaw gives us the title for this podcast. So, let's get started. It was Oma on February 29th, 2024, and we were in Bogan's Bar. It was our first trip to the town, and the theme was new beginnings. Here's first-timer Una Brogan.
So, a new beginning, a fresh chapter in my life that began on the 27th of June, 2013, when I was 26. It was the end of a difficult period that I associate in my mind with a song and a book. The song is Bob Dylan's It Ain't Me, Babe, which I was learning on the guitar at the time. And the novel is La Prisonnière, or The Captive, by Proust, which I read later and which recalled that time to me. So it was the end of my third year living in Paris. The first year I'd been studying, then I spent 2 more years squatting, bike couriering, working for an NGO, and making sporadic attempts to write. For 1 year I'd been in a relationship with a guy who was possessive and unstable. He had mental health problems, and even though I'd known we should break up for months, I couldn't bring myself to do it. He was trying to finish his master's, and I thought I'd try to support him through that and leave him once he'd handed in his dissertation. I was pretty depressed myself at the time, not knowing what direction to take in life. After a few months staying with my boyfriend's parents, who were both academics and who encouraged me to apply for a PhD, we'd moved in together in March to a cute little top floor apartment with tiny red ceramic floor tiles called Tomit. But I spent the spring fleeing that flat. I went to Dublin for a month for a translation internship. I flew back from Dublin and spent a horrible night in the apartment telling him it was over, but he reacted by smashing his computer and hard drive against the wall. Somehow we managed to repair it with tape. I left on the train the next morning to join a friend in northern Italy, nursing a painful and swelling boil on my upper lip. For a few days I'd lived off-grid, waking and going to sleep with the sun, fetching water from the well in the abandoned mountain village that my friend's grandparents had emigrated from. There had been a mass exodus in the 1930s when Mussolini started persecuting linguistic minorities because they spoke a dialect of French in that valley. We wandered into houses where everything had been abandoned. There was china in the buffets, cutlery in the drawers, documents on the kitchen table. I travelled back down from the mountain and onto an activist festival in Rome. My first stop, though, was the hospital, where my huge boil on my lip was lanced to an audience of impressed young doctors who said there's so much pus in there. Back in Paris, the month of June was a blur of tears and endless discussions. I was trying to prepare for an interview for a funded PhD place. My boyfriend kept an eye on me constantly, watching over my back as I typed emails or texts, going out with me even just for a short walk to the shop, clinging on and in effect making it impossible for me to contemplate or plan leaving him and moving out of the flat. It was at that time that my life resembled that of Proust's character Albertine in The Captive, who's held under house arrest by her jealous lover, the narrator. My boyfriend hummed along to It Ain't Me, Babe as I learnt it on the guitar, not paying any attention to the words. But when he sat down and read the lyrics, he flew into a rage and asked me to stop singing it. It's a song about breaking up with someone, like many of Dylan's songs. I remember a phone conversation with my childhood friend Sarah, who had recently broken up with her long-term boyfriend and was preparing to go travelling. She listened and gave me the strength to believe I could leave him. But I couldn't see how. I did try to pack a bag and go several times, but he stopped me, pleaded with me, cried and screamed. One evening, out of the blue, he took up his dad's invitation to go to the cinema, and I opted to stay at the flat. I called my mum. I hadn't explained the situation to her as such, not wanting to alarm her. But she's a woman of great intuition and had only one thing to say to me. Leave now. It was the first time in weeks I'd had any opportunity to make a break for it. I hung up and called my ex-squad mates who lived in a place not too far away. They said I was welcome and I cycled there, then texted my boyfriend to let him know I wouldn't be staying at the flat that night. He called in a panic asking me to tell him where I was before the phone cut off. His dad called me an hour later to say he'd smashed his phone but was calming down now and would go to his parents that night. For the next week or so, I went back and forth from the flat to get things. I stayed there the night before my PhD interview to try to get a good night's sleep. I was in a shared room at the squat. But he turned up in the early hours of the morning and creeped onto our mattress on the floor. So on the morning of the 27th of June 2013, after yet more torturous conversations, I cycled to the university and took the lift up to the fifth floor. I shared the lift with a professor who seemed to be my guardian angel. He had taught me a class on Rimbaud's poetry when I was an undergraduate, and he was on the selection panel when I got a scholarship to go to Paris 3 years before. It turned out he was on the interview panel for my PhD funding that morning too, with an intimidating 14 other people. I was the first up with my start of the alphabet surname. I tried my best to convince them all why they should fund my PhD on bicycles in literature, then got back on my bike to start moving out. I borrowed a massive trailer, then loaded up all my possessions onto it and cycled across sweltering Paris to a squat in the eastern suburbs where a friend was letting me leave my stuff for the summer. Then I loaded up my bike with all my touring gear and cycled to the train station, just in time for my southbound train. My friends had left a few days before to cycle to Marseille for a critical mass festival there. I had stayed behind for the PhD interview, but now the open road awaited. I sat back in the train seat, sweaty, exhausted and happy. After many months of depression and entanglement in a coercive relationship, I was finally free, as long as I didn't turn my phone on. The cycle to Marseille was magical and liberating. I started my funded PhD the following September. A year later, I fell head over heels in love with a man who I'm lucky enough to still have by my side, along with our two lovely kids.
Inna, thank you so much for that. What a powerful story. And what a fabulous topic for a PhD, Dr. Brogan. I hope we'll have you back again. As I'm always reminding you, 10x9 is constantly looking for storytellers, whether it's your first time like Una or not. It's always great to get your story, so get in touch via the website 10x9.com. It doesn't matter if it's just a vague idea or a fully formed epic, just get in touch. And if you're a bit nervous, shy or reluctant, I'll do my best to make it as easy a process as possible. Okay, on to our next story, and it's always great to hear Paul Whittington. He told this story at the Black Box in September when the theme was lucky.
Are you in charge of these teenagers? The heavily tattooed Scottish man barked, advancing towards me as I entered the bothy. Somewhat taken aback, I muttered, yes, yes, I am in charge. Well, let me tell you what just happened. Specks of spittle spraying from his mouth, his face red, muscles standing out on his neck, bulging eyes barely remaining in their sockets. It had been a successful day in the southern uplands. The young people were on the second day of their 3-day silver expedition, and two of the groups had arrived at their respective campsites on time. I had been persuaded to allow the girls' group to stay in the bothy, while the boys were camping about a kilometre further up the valley. Both were tired, but in good spirits. After going over their routes for the next day, I bade them sweet dreams and walked back down the track to where I'd parked the minibus. As I negotiated the bus along the heavily rutted and potholed lane to the main road, I passed two rough-looking, heavily tattooed, crew-cut hairstyle, muscles bulging on arms and shoulders, carrying large amounts of alcoholic beverage. These men would not look out of place as bouncers in a seedy Glasgow nightclub. As due to the absence of any camping equipment, I assumed they were heading for the Bothy. Of course, these gentlemen could have been salt of the earth, but it was a risk I couldn't take. Back at the Wooden Youth Hostel, I collected my equipment, bolted some food down, and got one of the other supervisors to leave me off at the bottom of the track. The sun was sinking in the sky, and everything seemed peaceful. As I walked up, saw the Bothy further up the track. I couldn't be sure, but it seemed like some people were leaving the Bothy quickly and heading up the valley in the direction of the boys' camp. A few minutes later, I entered to see a man pacing up and down in the small room with our girls huddled, cowering in the corner. It took several minutes to calm him down, and eventually he told me that when they arrived, the girls were already there. The men had made the girls cups of tea and made toast for them on the fire. I could see the girls' socks drying across the hearth, the steam rising off them. Then the boys arrived, and they were treated the same way. Cups of tea and toast were provided. When the man's back was turned, one of the boys took a swig of the man's whiskey and had the bottle at his mouth when the man turned round. The man exploded. I eventually discovered that his name was Declan. He was so angry that he caused all the boys to flee the scene. As he recounted the episode, his cheeks became flushed and the rage was rekindled. We made them tea and toast. We got on great, and then that wee bastard was negging my whiskey. The memory of this insult gave him energy to continue. You never steal another man's drink. What are you going to do about it? You're their teacher. He stood looking at me with a face mask of suppressed rage, his finger jabbing at air close to my chest. Calmly, I asked him to describe the boy, and from his description, I knew who the culprit was and was not surprised. I left assuring the man I would deal with the situation. The girls had quietly slipped out, climbing the stairs to the loft where they were to sleep. It took several minutes for my stressed body to return to normal. Later at the boys' campsite, I questioned Peter. Peter, tell me what happened at the Bothy. None happened. Why did you and the others flee like the devil was after you? Peter looked away, but eventually said, the man was very angry for some reason. He was very scary. Have you any idea why he was angry? Peter just shrugged. I leaned in close to his face. Why do I smell whiskey on your breath? Peter's bottom lip wobbled and tears filled his eyes. He wiped the tears back with the back of his hand. I thought he was going to kill me. I was so scared. I waited. He looked pleadingly at me. All I did was take a small swig of his whiskey. Did he offer you some of his whiskey? He shook his head. Right, grab your torch. You and I are going back to the Bothy. No, sir, no, he'll kill me. No, he'll probably shout a lot, but he'll not touch you. When you go in there, you just apologise for what you have done. Peter walked slowly beside me as we ambled down the track in Trappist silence. Lights were still on the downstairs room of the Bothy. Peter stood outside the door, gulping lungfuls of air. He squared his shoulders and followed me inside. Declan and his friend rose from their seats either side of the fire, faces like thunder. Declan, this is Peter. He has something to say. I turned to the side, but Peter was not there. Fearing he had bolted, I whirled round to see Peter standing very close behind me, hiding. I nodded, and slowly he stepped out to the side, his eyes downcast to the floor. I leant in and whispered, "Look at him, Peter." Peter nodded slightly, lifted his face, took a deep breath. "Mister, I'm really sorry I stole your whiskey." Declan stared hard at Peter, and then he walked slowly towards Peter, his hands clenched in fists. "Oh, fuck," I heard Peter mutter under his breath. His body was tense, his eyes fixed on the large man advancing towards him. He stood several paces in front of Peter. My body was tense, preparing myself to step between them, although I would be as much use as a sheet of newspaper was in stopping a train. Listen, son, never steal a man's drink, he said in a thick Glaswegian accent. He paused, then grabbed Peter's shoulders and enveloped him in a massive bear hug. I thought Peter was going to faint. Declan turned and returned to his seat by the fire. Peter looked at me. I nodded my head towards the door and quickly he scurried out and headed back up the track to the campsite. Will you take a drink with us? Declan said. Yes, thank you, but first I must go and see if the girls are okay. I deposited my rucksack at the door, walked up the narrow steps to the loft, knocked, turned on my head torch and opened the door. All six girls were cocooned in their sleeping bags. All faces looked anxious and fearful. Lucy, the girl closest to the door, was sitting and clutched in her hand was a large bow saw, its blade pointed at the door. Hi, girls, everyone okay? I said. Lucy lowered the bow saw. I walked over and gently took the bow saw from her hand and placed it beside the door. No one spoke. I always stay the night downstairs so there's nothing to worry about. Are they still angry? Tracy asked. Everything's sorted, Tracy. They were so good to us. Made us tea and toast. They were great. Even took our socks and hung them up near the fire. We were having a great time until that arse Peter... Realising what she was just about to say, she quickly added, Sorry, sir. Well, he is a complete dick. Tracy, that hole is getting deeper that you're digging. Well, he is, she muttered huffily. Okay, girls, I'll see you in the morning. No, sir, please don't go. Stay with us tonight. All six faces looked pleadingly at me. I'm going down to chat to our friends. I will be back later. They all shuffled their sleeping bags further away from the door, leaving a space for me. The two men were great company, and I had several drinks, maybe a few more than several. I learnt that once a month, every month, they would go to different bothies to maintain the buildings. No one mentioned the incident of the stolen whiskey. Later on, I rather unsteadily climbed the stairs, quietly opened the door to see six mounds in a long row. In the space left for me was a large bow saw. Next morning, as the girls were saying goodbye to Declan and his mate, the men were pleasantly surprised that the girls gave each of them a hug. Outside, as we went over the route for the next day, Tracy said, Sir, you snore loudly. Your wife must be a saint. I noticed that they all nodded agreement. I said, Well, yes, she is a very lucky woman, I replied. They rolled their eyes and looked at me with a condescending smile. After they left, I said my farewells to my new best friends, walked down the track thinking I was lucky that even though Declan and his mate looked so hard and dangerous, they had behaved like perfect gentlemen to our girls. The following week, back in the headmaster's study, he asked how the expedition had gone. I told him that all the groups had done well, recounted a couple of funny incidents and how lucky we were with the weather. I said that in future we would not be allowing any groups to stay to use bothies on the expedition. He looked surprised and had a feeling he wanted to talk about this, which I did not, as it was his idea, having stayed a night in a Scottish bothy himself and thinking it was a marvellous experience. Fortuitously, the phone rang on his desk. Annoyed, he lifted the phone and, covering the mouthpiece, said, We'll talk again. I rose, nodded and left. That conversation never happened.
Safeguarding not a big priority at your school then, Paul? Oh, we live in such different times now, Paul, eh? Thanks for the great story. And how lucky was that young man to have someone sensible like you at hand. Stay away from the bothies and the whiskey. Now, you know 10x9 is always free, but if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, that's 10by9.com. And I just want to say a big thank you to the following. I've got a little list here. Barbara Barnes, Maureen Gregg, Malachy O'Doherty, Kevin McAteer, Siobhan McGuigan, Joy Perkins, Mark McGrath, Paula Tabakin, Jane Prendy, Darius Whelan, Samara Pitt, Katie Whitehead, The Killicks, and the lovely Beck Aiken. Thank you all so much. And also a big thank you to everyone who has given at our live events over the years. You are not forgotten, and we are so grateful. Okay, on to our third and final story in this podcast, and it's from a first-timer. Say hello to Jakob or Kuba Glogowski.
1,500 miles east of Dublin lies Radom, a city in Poland where I was born. On the outskirts of that city is a village called Antoniówka, where my grandparents now live. Ever since I moved away from Poland 16 years ago, I've always looked forward to visiting my grandparents every year. They're funny, generous, great storytellers, and have big hearts filled with love. Every visit to go see them is bliss, and I have many stories to share. And this one is about our first adventure on August 3rd, 2018. That was the day my family decided that me, my brother, and my grandparents would be going to Warsaw for a day trip. I had been highly anticipating this day, as I had already wanted to see the capital just out of sheer curiosity. I never lived far from it, only 100 kilometers, and all I knew up to that point in my life was the occasional beach holiday, my city of Radom, and a few places here and there in Northern Ireland, so my mind wondered at the possibilities of what this place could possibly look like. It certainly didn't take long to be impressed either. We were welcomed to the city by incredibly modern apartments, offices, roads that were a complete opposite to the dullness of Radom, as they were coloured with sleek greys, blacks and whites. If money talks and wealth whispers, Warsaw is silent. All you need to do is look around you and you know where the money is in Poland. That's not what charmed me the most, nor was it the science museum we visited shortly upon arrival. It was where we went straight after the museum that stole my heart, Warsaw's old town. Picture this. We make our way over to a short stone bridge, no more than a few steps long. On the other side is a brick oval tower, with an entrance resembling a castle. You might wonder why there is such a bold entrance. Well, I'll tell you why. It's because the old town is the diamond of Warsaw. As soon as you walk past those gates, you're transported into an entire different world that juxtaposes the modernity of Warsaw. The old town leans into its history in such a beautiful way that gives the place a lot of charm. Every house, cathedral, restaurant was brightly colored and welcoming. There were narrow streets that led to huge, vast squares that could fit the entire population, and then some. On this bright summer's day, it felt like I was in a children's cartoon, with why everything looked so bright and friendly. If you're having a hard time imagining this, just think of the opposite of Belfast, and that should help you. This is a point where I became deeply and utterly fascinated with this world. Being 14, I usually complained if I had to leave the house. Not this time. I had such a bustling energy about me, and a desire to experience everything the old town had to offer. Although my grandparents and my brother were more reserved than I was, I could tell they had a quiet, calm happiness about them, and it made the experience all the better because of it. The adventure didn't end there either. I was going to experience all three courses, and everyone knows you've got to leave some room for dessert. The dessert in question was a palace of culture and science, one of the tallest buildings in the capital. I can't begin to tell you the boldness of this absolutely mighty beast of a building. It was built during the 50s, so has a classical grandeur that is still incredibly impressive for the modern era, while having an almost pyramid-like structure. What I mean is, the building isn't just one tall, lanky thing that pokes out. No, it has its say with a wide, large base at the bottom, with the main tower protruding out. One of the touristy things you can do is take the elevator up to the 30th floor of the building, onto the viewing platform, where you can have an entire 360-degree panoramic view of Warsaw, which is exactly what we planned to do. I don't remember anything about the interior of a building, mind you, apart from a marble appearance and, strangely, a Mike Wazowski statue that oddly feels incredibly out of place. Moving on, my grandparents bought the tickets, and off we went over to the elevator, where a formally dressed woman sat on a stool and silently pressed the button to lead us up to the 30th floor. If the design of the building itself didn't give the place a sense of luxury, the woman's presence surely did, making me wonder about the exclusivity of such a building and what the purpose of the other floors might be. I glanced over at the display and tried to imagine what I'd see at the top. When the display showed the 30, the elevator doors welcomed us out. It didn't take long for me to make my way over to the windows, as I needed to see the view. As promised, the windows were located in all four walls. They didn't have any glass on them, so they had to be covered with cages on the outside. Now, while these cages were a bit of an eyesore, it did not take away from the experience at all. Looking out over the windows, it looked as if Warsaw was never ending in every direction. Pedestrians were dots, the cars were Lego bricks, and buildings looked like I could pick them up with my hand from this height. I thought that, if I was a god, this is how I'd see the world. Everything looked so insignificant, yet if you were down there, it wouldn't be. I was in awe of it all. Now, while this adventure was short, it meant a lot to me. First of all, without my grandparents, it wouldn't have had that same charm. Not only because of how much I love them, but because they make everything so much funnier. For example, during the trip, I stepped into a car exhibit with my grandfather in the museum, without reading what the exhibit was called. This was a mistake, as when me and my grandfather pressed buttons in the car, we heard certain bedroom sounds and educational anecdotes about sex. I was not surprised to find out the exhibit was called The Car of Love. And having that prior knowledge would have saved me buckets of embarrassment. That wasn't all, as later on in the day, my grandmother made a comment about how hard the woman's in the elevator's job must be. But don't worry, but not because it's hard work or anything, but because of the possibility of someone farting. Which the woman definitely heard, as I could see her struggling to maintain her iron glare that the job expected of her. Funny stories aside, the adventure made me discover just how much I loved sightseeing and traveling. After Warsaw, me and my grandparents, and sometimes the rest of my family, would visit other places in Poland, including Krakow and Gdańsk, going on even bigger, longer adventures that I would love to tell someday. We don't just bond on shared experiences. For instance, this summer, my grandparents went to Norway to experience the majestic fjords, thanks to a Polish holidaymaker. And I myself went to the Netherlands to explore the great city of Amsterdam, one of my favorite places I had ever been, all by myself. When one of us was away, we'd keep in touch over Facebook by sending photos, without failing to amaze either one of us. It is incredibly hard moving away from family. I would sacrifice so much for the ability to just be able to get into a car, drive however long, and be in their presence. As simple as that. Yet, it is nice to know that any time I'm on an adventure, I'll be able to tell them my stories, and they'll tell me theirs, over some of the nicest tea I've ever had in my life, in their cozy home in Antoniówka.
Oh, Kuba, thank you so much. That was such a sweet story, told beautifully. The audience really fell in love with you and your story. Thank you. I hope you'll be back with us again soon. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website. The dates for 2025 are all there, along with a couple of themes to get you thinking. 10x9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our Instagram, and I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who makes 10x9 live events happen wherever they are. The wonderful Leanne and Margaret and Chris and Cara. The lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. The audience, of course, they really make the storytellers and me feel right at home. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers everywhere. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Una Brogan, Paul Whittington, and Kuba Glagowski. I'm Paul Doran, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.